What a day. Welcome, friends, to Economic Update, a weekly program that looks at the jobs, the incomes, the wages, the debts, all of the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your weekly host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my life, as I say to you at the beginning of each of these programs. I want to let you know, however, today that we are beginning to change the format a little bit of this program to update it. We benefit from having now over 3 years of experience, from being broadcast on over 35 stations, and from beginning to do this program in a video and television format. Over the next few weeks, you'll see some changes, but they are minor and they will not affect the basic thrust of the program. So let's get started. For those of you that are new for the first time, welcome. We're glad to have you. And for the rest, well, we hope you enjoy the show as we do each week. Let me begin, of course, with the elections, because those are the most recent big events that affect our economy in countless ways. I'm going to have more to say later in this program about the economics of these elections. It's clear that the forces against progressive change did very well in this election, and nothing I say should be understood to take away from that harsh but serious reality. But I wanted to make sure some other dimensions of the elections are also in folks' minds, particularly folks that find their way to this program. On election day, the voters in San Francisco, California, approved by a 77-23% margin Proposition J. And Proposition J raises the minimum wage for all workers in San Francisco in a series of steps culminating in July 2018 with a $15 per hour minimum wage. This so-called fight for 15 was started, of course, by Kashama Sawant, the socialist alternative candidate for city council who won that seat in Seattle last year. And so this is a sign that what she said then, that this was part of a longer, bigger national struggle, proves her to have been right and to have understood something perhaps better than many of us. At the same time on Election Day, Oakland, right next door to San Francisco, across the bay, there the voters voted by an 81% margin to approve Measure FF in that town, which likewise raises the minimum wage in the very large city of Oakland. Doesn't raise it as far as the folks in San Francisco's bill did, but the direction of change is unmistakable. I wanted also to mention the following states in which there were ballot initiatives that did result in victories for raising the minimum wage. Those states are Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota. And in the state of Illinois, a measure passed that is just an advisory to the state government, but it made clear that the majority of voters in that large state also support raising the minimum wage. Nearby, that is nearby Oakland and San Francisco, is the town of Richmond. It has been on this program repeatedly, partly because of their creative use of eminent domain to try to deal with the mortgage and housing crisis, but they've also been in a struggle over many environmental and related financial issues with the huge Chevron Corporation. And the election last week enabled the Chevron Corporation to be defeated, and I wanted to underscore that. The slate of candidates, from the mayor on to several city council members, were opposed by Chevron, which spent apparently quite a bit of money to defeat them, something corporations are doing increasingly. But in the town of Richmond, where there's been a struggle for a long time and people understand what's going on, despite Chevron's money, the candidates supported by Chevron lost, and the candidates opposed to Chevron won. So the election was, to say the least, a mixed story. But as I say, we'll come back to that. The next update deals with Ebola. A great deal has been said about the Ebola epidemic, the horrible damage it is doing in Western Africa, and the threat that it may or may not represent on a broader scale. But I don't have time to deal with many of the interesting economic aspects, but one in particular caught my eye when I listened to a speech given last week and reported on in the New York Times of November 4th, a speech by Dr. Margaret Chan. She is the person in charge of the World Health Organization efforts around the Ebola situation. And I want to read to you, because her words are excellent, what she said in that speech widely reported. Here we go. Quote, "A market-driven industry does not invest in products for markets that cannot pay." Here's what she meant. The Ebola issue, the Ebola virus, was discovered back in 1976. Many, many years ago. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, then called Zaire. To date, 13,567 people have contracted the disease, and just shy of 5,000 people have died of it. This is a very serious problem. So why was nothing done to develop the vaccines, which we now know are quite promising in that area, for such a long time? Dr. Chan gives us an economy answer, an answer that focuses on the economics of this situation. The industry that produces vaccines is a private capitalist enterprise. Their job, their number one priority, is to be profitable. They apparently chose not to develop a vaccine for the Ebola crisis because the people who are suffering from it don't have the capacity to pay for the kinds of drugs and vaccines needed to deal with it. Profits, not the life and death needs of people, govern the enterprises to whom we entrust the production of medicine in our world. That's what Dr. Chan had the courage to say, and that's a key lesson here. The next update has to do with mortgages here in the United States, although similar problems afflict the rest of the world. Let's review the story of mortgages. First of all, a mortgage is simply a fancy name for a loan made to a person where the money that the person borrows is used to buy his or her home. So mortgages are just home loans, loans made to people to buy homes. In the old days, that is for the last 200 years or more, here's how it usually worked. You want to buy a home, but you don't have enough money. That's the vast majority of us. So you go to a bank and you borrow the money to buy the house. When you borrow that money, it's called taking out a mortgage. That's all the word means. And the arrangement is the following. The bank gives you the money, which you use to buy the house. You now owe the bank that lent you the money all that you borrowed to buy the house, and the bank works out with you a schedule of monthly payments, usually lasting 10, 15, 20, or even longer years, because this is a big loan, and most people need a long time to pay it off. So you pay the bank every month a certain amount over a certain number of years, basically paying off the loan, which hopefully ends up with you owning the house with the debt finished and paid off. The new way, that's about 20 years old, is the bank doesn't do that. That is, it lends you the money, you buy the house, but the bank doesn't hold on to your mortgage debt. You pay the bank every month, but the bank doesn't keep the mortgage debt, your debt, what you owe. It sells it to an investor. You don't know that because they don't have to tell you. You keep sending money to the bank, but all the bank does is collect it, take a little fee for managing all of this, and send it on to the investor to whom they sold your obligation to pay for 20 years, so and so many dollars a month. Okay? This change might sound detailed, technical, but it was an earth-shaking change. Why? Because when banks lent you the money, and you really owed the bank, and the bank had your debt on its books, the bank was going to make real sure that you could pay. It wasn't going to lend you the money if it meant a risk that it felt it did not want to bear. The government got into the act during the Great Depression to give all kinds of insurances and benefits to banks so that even if you didn't pay back or couldn't, then the government would kind of make up the difference. The government acting like an insurer of last resort for home loans, for mortgage loans. But be that as it may, the banks who made the loans no longer cared, really, whether you could pay it back or not, because it wasn't their problem. They had sold your mortgage debt to somebody else, a private investor, the government. It really didn't matter to the bank. Once they sold your mortgage, they had the money back in their hands, and they went out looking for another character to whom to lend to buy a house. You can see the money for the banks because every time they lent, there were those famous points, those commissions that the banks get for bringing together the person who needs to borrow to buy a home with the money that that person needs. So the banks were happily pushing mortgage loans on people. They would be happy to give anyone who wasn't dead a mortgage in the go-go years of 2004, 5, 6, and 7. Why? Because as soon as that mortgage had been signed by both parties, the bank that made the loan sold it off to somebody else, and it was their headache. We know the result. The mortgage market collapsed when millions of investors discovered that the people they owned the debts of, the mortgage debts of, couldn't pay because they had borrowed for houses they could not afford, under terms they did not understand. Why? Because the banks were eager to push the money on them, sign the documents, and then resell them. All of this meant that in the aftermath of the collapse of 2007 and 8, driven first and foremost by what we then called the subprime mortgage market, but the real truth of it was the subprime mortgage market existed because banks had this new incentive to get anybody who could sign their name onto the mortgage document, because the banks were churning them over and making a fortune in the process. So the Dodd-Frank bill, laboriously crafted in 2009 and 10 here in the United States to try to deal with this, came up with a rule. They didn't come up with it too quickly. They were supposed to do this in 2010. They finally came up with the rule a few weeks ago, 4 years late. That's how powerful the housing and banking industries are to prevent any limits on how they make money. But at least they were supposed to come up with the rule now. But in the last minute, they decided not to apply the number one rule that the Dodd-Frank deliberations had come up with. And the rule was a bank that makes a mortgage loan has to hold on to at least part of that loan in many cases. It was called keeping skin in the game. That the bank would have an interest in that mortgage being paid back was the way the government thought it could prevent the wild, corrupt manipulation that brought us to the crisis in the first place, and that they could clearly see, and that they were supposed to prevent. In the last analysis, the housing industry, they want to sell houses. And the banking industry, they want to write mortgages, got that provision eliminated. It's amazing. In the clever words of Barney Frank of the Frank Dodd bill, the exemption, that is, they wouldn't have to own a piece of the mortgage, ate the rule, he said. He was disgusted by what had happened to all the work he put in, to this little bit of control that the government was going to impose. Gone. It's important for everyone to understand that once again, the banks can what's called securitize these loans, sell the loan as fast as they make it to a homeowner to somebody else. But the private big banks in America that do this aren't going to find private investors. They got burned the last time down, so they're not going to do it. Well, then to whom will the banks sell the mortgages they now write that they don't have to keep any part of themselves? The only people who will buy it are the government of the United States, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, now wholly owned by the government. They are the final financial entities that will buy all of these mortgages from the banks. So let me drive home what that means, so nobody is under any illusion about this. It means that the overwhelming majority of mortgages written from now on, like those of the last 5 years of this crisis, are written by a bank which does not keep it, but in fact sells it to the United States government. Standing behind our housing market, which is one of the most important supports of our economy, is the government. I want those who are conservatives just to understand that it was the pressure of the conservatives not to require the banks to keep some skin in the game, to keep a part of every mortgage. That means now that the banks will freely write the mortgages, and the only money backstopping the mortgage market is the federal government. They gave the government that enormous influence on the economy. If, for any reason, the federal government, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, excuse me, if they didn't buy these mortgages, the banks wouldn't write them. And if the banks didn't write them, then there would be no demand for housing in the United States, because the overwhelming majority of people who buy houses in the United States have to go to a bank to borrow. If the bank isn't going to lend, because the government isn't the place to dump your mortgage when you're a bank and you've written it up with somebody, well, then the demand for housing in the United States will collapse. And the value of the home, of everybody listening to this program, will drop by 30%, by 50%. No one knows. What's keeping your house worth what you think it's now worth is, therefore, the government, not the private sector, not the private market, the government. And without the government, Lord help us, as an economic system, fragile that we are. The next update is about the People's Republic of China, which is doing something rather remarkable, and because our press doesn't cover these things very well, I thought I would, and that you would find it as interesting as I do. Chinese officials have announced an effort to limit the pay of their chief executive officers, their CEO, the top executive of their corporations, at least at the state-owned corporations. And the state owns many important corporations in China. Their rule that they want to impose, that the top executive cannot earn more than 10 times the average worker pay. Here in the United States, at big corporations, that ratio is about 250 times. The Chinese want to make executive pay much, much lower. 10 times the average worker's pay. So committed are the leaders that the current president in China, and excuse please my poor pronunciation, Xi Jinping, declared this past summer, quote, excessive salaries should be adjusted. And he is chairing the new high-level panel, chaired by the president of the country, that is chartered to put the cap on executive salaries in place. As an example, in China, they used the China Construction Bank, the world's third largest bank by assets. It is currently paying its top executive 73 times what average Chinese workers make. Now, that's already way lower than the 250 here in this country, but it is way above the 10 times that they're shooting for. So this represents a serious attack inside China on the super high executive salaries. Having said that, let's keep a perspective. The chair of China's mammoth industrial and commercial bank, one of the 10 or 20 richest and biggest banks in the world, last year took home $320,000. That's the U.S. value for his annual pay. That was compared to the head of Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, who took home $20 million. The top executive in China of its biggest bank took home 1.6% of what the top banker at J.P. Morgan Chase in New York took home. Remarkable. Worth a story. And I think I can boast you heard it here, although I also could mention other places that carried this story too. We are not the only one. Next, a piece of work done by Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zuckman, Two economists who wrote a paper in October of 2014 for the National Bureau of Economic Research. Emmanuel Saez, by the way, is very well known because of his many, many years of research with Thomas Piketty, that famous French economist whose book, Capital in the 21st Century, has caused such a stir around the world, and especially in English-speaking countries over the last 6 months. Their research shows where the wealth has gone that was created in this country since 1986. So we're talking about a generation since 1986. A generation of people have been working in this country, 28 years to be exact, to produce wealth. And indeed, wealth has been produced in the United States. But the question asked by Professors Saez and Zuckman were, where did that wealth go? Into whose household did it settle? Here are the statistics, and they are as stunning as any that I know of in terms of getting clear what's going on in this society. The bottom 90% of Americans had their household wealth increased by 1.1%. All of the rest of the increase went to people in the top 10%. Of the distribution of wealth. In other words, for an entire generation, 90% of the people basically stayed where they were in terms of the wealth they had. And all of the output that accrued to rising wealth went to the very richest. No wonder the Occupy Wall Street folks were so much on target when they talked about the 1% versus the 99%. I'm going to turn now to responding to some questions that you have sent in and for which we are, of course, grateful. As always, I want to remind you before I begin that we maintain two websites that carry a great deal of material available to you 24/7 at no charge, and that include the capacity for you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, so you can keep up with our work, enable you to see where the kind of analysis you see on here on this program goes, in terms of a whole range of topics. And it also allows you to send us questions, comments, and criticisms. rdwolf.com with two F's and democracyatwork.info are the websites. And so I'm going to answer some of the questions that came. But before I do, I want to read something to you that came in that isn't a question, but it's a description. Maybe I'll paraphrase to save time. It's a worker at a Costco company, that famous mass retailer scattered across America. This worker works at the Costco in San Bernardino, California. And he talks about, or she talks about, how once upon a time it was really great to work at Costco. You got promoted, you got a decent salary, you had a sense of being in a company that cared for you, and Costco became quite famous for offering much better working conditions and wages than most of the big box retailers around the country. But then the crash came in 2007, and the retirement of the former CEO, Jim Singel. And according to this worker, things have gone down at Costco ever since. She complains clearly that wages are not what they were. Incentives are not what they were. Working conditions have deteriorated. Part-timers are replacing full-timers. The usual story. Why do I tell you this? Because this is an example of the dependence of the mass of people, the majority, those who should be in democratic control, the dependence of them on a tiny number of people who run the big corporations. And who can decide when they want, and for whatever reasons they want, to radically alter the work experience of the majority. A minority transforms the work experience, the wages, the chance for promotion, everything about your job, decided by a handful of people over whom you have no control. They tell you what they're going to do or how they're going to treat you. Take it or leave it, you're done. And if you leave and go to another company, you'll find exactly the same conditions there. You know, we talked a few weeks ago about a supermarket in Massachusetts and New England, Market Basket, where the workers successfully had demonstrations, organized politicians to push for one executive versus another to get a better deal. This only reminds me, as this story from Costco does, of the peasants over the millennia of feudalism and prior systems in Europe, who periodically would become so angry about what was happening to them that they would demonstrate and ask for a different king or a different queen to take over. I have the same question I always do. When will we as a people stop hoping that those in charge will treat us well? Stop complaining when they inevitably decide to take care of themselves at our expense? When will we finally realize that we oughtn't to be dependent on a minority that we don't choose, because that's not democratic? We ought to be in charge so that we make the decisions that shape our conditions. And that's as true for the workers at Costco as for those at Market Basket as it was for those peasants when they had to learn that lesson, too. Another question came in about nonprofit foundations. Why do corporations set them up? The question was. Well, I think it's important to understand that foundations are a kind of window dressing. They allow corporations to do things that are not normally available to them. First of all, a nonprofit is the wrong name. You don't really mean nonprofit, because the only way to know what the profit of an enterprise is to be one of the accountants who keep the books. Otherwise, you're dependent on the public relations press releases the company gives out. And if you believe that, then you also believe that there's a special person who flies into your room at night and puts a special gift under your pillow when your tooth comes out as a child. I'm assuming there aren't too many of you who believe that. A nonprofit really means a tax exempt, a company that doesn't have to pay taxes on what it earns, whether it calls them profits or not. Many of them don't. But the foundations they set up, they can give shares to. This will allow them to claim a donation to a tax-exempt institution. They get tax benefits for that. They don't really lose the power because they sit on the board of the foundation to whom their corporation gave the shares. So it's the same people, again, just with two different hats. I could go on and on and on, but the foundations set up by corporations are mostly about tax advantages, public relations advantages, control advantages. They have something to do with doing well in the world, sure, and in some cases more than others. But they don't exist in all the corporations of this country because they are great, real, wonderful folks. It's because their accountants explain to them what the benefits are. Okay, we've come to the end of the first half of this program. We're going to take our mid-program break. Please come back with me. We'll be back in a matter of seconds for the second half of this program. Welcome back, friends. This is the second half of Economic Update for this week. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And in this second half of the program, we take a number of big issues that have occurred over the last week or two, and we subject them to a kind of in-depth analysis that we hope you will find informative, educational, and just plain interesting. Well, I want to start by talking about the elections. We had a national election here in the United States this last week, and it raises a whole host of questions. I'm not going to go over what has been said in many other locations. There's no point in it. You've already heard that, or you will if you haven't already. I want to talk about the larger economic questions raised by this election. So let's begin. I think one of the most important ways to start talking about the election on November 4th was the following: that something on the order of 27%, if I have the numbers right, 27% of the people eligible to vote, that is, they're old enough, they're citizens, they haven't committed any kind of offense that disqualifies you from voting. If you look at the total number of people qualified to vote, about 27% of those people chose to vote. The overwhelming majority of the American people weren't interested enough or had some other reason why they did not vote. Some of them were intimidated. The Republican Party took great efforts in a variety of places to make it more difficult to vote. You had to have various kinds of identity. You had to identity pieces. You had to show them all kinds of obstacles. And that's for a simple reason. The statistics of American voting have been crystal clear for many, many years, that in general, the people, the Democrats win if we have more people voting and the Republicans if we have less. Because the people who are not so sure they want to go to the polls are those Democrats. So that if the Democrats want to win, they have to create a motivation, a fairly special motivation, to get out extra numbers of people. To cross the 50% threshold is always the goal and very difficult in this country. Usually only happens when there's a president, and even then, it's difficult. Okay, what's the lesson here? Barack Obama came into office in the elections of 2008 and stayed in the election of 2012 because, first of all, in 2008 and to a much lesser degree in 2012, he inspired large numbers of Americans who normally don't vote. And how do we know they normally don't vote? Well, I just told you, they didn't vote this last week. They didn't vote in the midterm elections 4 years ago, etc. They don't normally vote. Well, Obama inspired them. He had a slogan of hope and change, some of you may remember, and it was the thought crossed the minds, particularly of younger people, that maybe, finally, there would be a politician who would give you a reason to have hope that there might be real change. One of the reasons the election came out the way it did this last week was because Mr. Obama and the Democrats systematically demonstrated to the millions of particularly younger people who were enthusiastic for them that they had misplaced their confidence that there would be very little change and therefore no way to sustain hope. And the results this week are the sign of what has happened. Nor should we be surprised. We have a history now going back a long time of presidents who come into office promising a change, a difference, a renewed something or other, and then go out of office 4 or 8 years later with a popularity rating somewhere in the basement because everybody has realized it was all hype, it was all empty promises, it didn't amount to much. Does that mean there are no differences between the two parties? No, there are some. And for some people, those differences matter. But I think for most people, they don't, because that's why they don't go. For them, it just doesn't matter that the issues that they feel strongly about are not being addressed by either party or are being addressed in a way that make you think they're just lying or they're just talking for the votes or something else that makes you turn away in revulsion, in disgust, and after a while you don't pay any attention, you lose interest, all the logical outcomes. Is there a basis for this attitude on the majority of the people, that for the basic things of life it doesn't matter? Well, I think if you look at the economics of this election, as I'm about to do with you, I think you'll see that there's quite a bit of justification. Let me show that to you. Every poll, every questionnaire, countless radio and television programs, this one included, have discovered that the American people are deeply concerned about the growing and extreme inequality of wealth and income in the United States. Large majorities believe that that's not good. Large majorities believe that we ought to have a much narrower gap between rich and poor than the one that has been getting wider and wider. Did the Republicans or the Democrats offer any kind of basic approach to solving that problem? And the answer is an unequivocal no. Neither party seems to be willing or interested in doing anything to stop this inequality that's gotten worse. The Republicans might be considered more happy that it's getting more unequal than the Democrats, but this is a degree of relative happiness, relative inaction in the face of this inequality. So I think a person who looked at these two parties and these two candidates looking for someone to really come forward and make a commitment to a serious set of steps that would do something about inequality, that would be a person who could be understood to turn away from this election choice in most cases and not participate. An exception might be if you were in an area, and there weren't many, where there was a third or fourth party candidate who actually said something about this, a Green Party candidate or something like that. But in most places where we vote in this country, there was no such option. Here's a second economic issue that Americans are deeply concerned about and have been for half a century: the exodus of jobs. We are losing jobs to other parts of the world. We are permitting major employers to shut down production here and move it over there, to take the profits they earn and invest them over there, not here. That's a serious problem. It affects every community. I mean, I won't again talk about Detroit, where you have seen the exodus of auto jobs leading to the collapse of a major urban area. Now in bankruptcy, Detroit is the largest bankruptcy, urban bankruptcy in American history. You'd expect a serious political campaign, for example, the one in Michigan, to deal with the exodus of jobs. What are you going to do to really prevent that from happening? And you can't come forward with some namby-pamby, I'm going to create incentive, because that's what has been said for 50 years. You certainly have to understand that an American citizen who looks at what the alternatives are sees that neither party is very interested, and that at most you get a rehash of the very wavy commitments that you heard 4, 8, 16, and so on years ago. You turn away in disgust. Here's a third example. The last time we had an economic crisis on the scale of this one was in the 1930s. And in those years, one of the things the president did was the following. He created a public jobs program. That's right. The government would hire people, pay them a salary, and put them to work doing something useful. Americans built the national parks we've enjoyed for the last 75 years. Those Americans hired by the federal government did some of the first ecological reclamation projects, the Civilian Conservation Corps. They built municipal buildings, libraries. They did loads and loads of useful things that we have all benefited from while being employed and earning an income that allowed them to keep their homes, raise their children. We would have expected, at the very least, that the parties would put forward a program, a debate about a program for public employment. But we wouldn't have found it, would we? No candidates, with a handful of exceptions, even spoke about it, let alone came up with a commitment that they could go to the voters with, elect me, I'm going to work on that from day one. So you could get a person looking at the election, knowing a little bit about American history, being disgusted by what was not offered by either party. Well, I could go on. The collapsing cities, Detroit, Cleveland, Camden, my hometown, Youngstown, Ohio, countless. What's going to be what program is there? Are they all going to follow Detroit? Declining, sinking, decade after decade, and nobody does anything? That's it? That's what the two parties offer us? That's what they delivered on Detroit. That's what they delivered on Cleveland, on Camden, and so on. Would we be able to understand the person who walks away from looking at that disaster saying, I'm not going to participate in a farce in which I'm to choose between two candidates, neither of whom addresses any of these fundamental economic issues? Is there still a reason to prefer one to the other? Sure. There's always, when you have two non-entities, two who don't deal with the real issues, it's still always possible to find one is less evil than the other. That's how many people still go, and they vote for the lesser evil. But then they really can't be surprised if nothing much changes. If this whole election business is a kind of farce designed to deflect our interest, to get us all excited about marginal differences that don't deal with what we know are the fundamental issues. Do some of those other issues that they do bring forward matter? Sure they do. But it's hard to take a process seriously that keeps saying, no, 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 we're not going to deal with the big ones. But here, get all excited about our differences on these. Is this a system designed to bring hope? I don't think so. This is a system that smashes hope on the few occasions when it even allows it to bloom for a while, the way the first Obama campaign did. The inescapable conclusion, if you want to deal with the basic economic change that this country needs and that our political system evades and avoids, you're going to have to do one of two things. You're either going to have to build an altogether new political party that looks at this stuff and says what changes it stands for, so that for the first time, people concerned about these basic economic issues actually have a choice. Or you're going to have to develop a movement from below, like they did in the 1930s. In those days, it was the CIO, the unions, the socialist, and the communist parties. In our time, who knows who will actually do it? How many of us would have expected the Occupy Wall Street to be as successful as they were for a while? But they show the way, a movement from below, which, if it can be sustained and organized, can begin to force our political parties, even the two half-dead ones that we have, to deal with the real issues. If we don't, we will allow a smaller and smaller number of people, many of whom don't care about the basic economic issues because they don't have them. They're in the top 10% of our population. Or they're in such need and they're so sad and pressurized that even for a little difference, for that lesser evil, they'll keep going and voting, even as they complain bitterly about how little really changes. The next issue I want to bring to your attention is, in a sense, the consequences of all of this. A report released on the 28th of October 2014 by UNICEF, a world-renowned, world-famous institution, one of whose major concerns is the condition of children. And they issued, as they do every year, a report card. It's called the Innocenti report card, this one number 12. And it had a title, Children of the Recession. And here's the subtitle, The Impact of the Economic Crisis on Child Well-Being in Rich Countries. Now, bear with me here. This report only looked at the 41 richest countries out of the nearly 200 countries we have on our planet. The 41 richest countries. And here's what it found were the results of the recession. By that, they basically mean the conditions between 2007 and today, the recession, they politely call it. Here's what they found for the 41 richest countries. And before I go through it, let me remind you that what happened to children in the richest countries is nowhere near as bad as what happened to children in all the poorer countries for all the usual reasons. So remember, I'm only talking about what UNICEF studied, which is the 41 richest. Here we go. 76.5 million children live in poverty in the 41 richest countries. We see unspeakable wealth concentrated in small numbers of people. Where? Almost exclusively in those 41 countries. And that incredible wealth concentrated in a few hands sits side by side with 76.5 million children living in poverty. In 29 of the 41 richest countries, the UNICEF survey shows an increase in the percentage of those who responded who report not having enough money to buy food for themselves and their families. In 29, in a clear majority of the 41 richest countries, there's been a growth in the percentage of people who don't have enough food. In Greece, they just picked that country, the shares of respondents saying, quote, they experienced stress yesterday, jumped from 49% in 2006 to 74% in 2013. In the United States, the share of respondents, these are randomly chosen, that have experienced not having enough money to buy food doubled from 10 to 20% of the American people. Don't worry, I won't do too much of this. You get the picture. In 28 out of the 31 European countries, the poverty rate has increased more rapidly for the young than for the elderly. And the reason that's very important is that growing poverty for the young has consequences for a much longer time than growing poverty for the elderly, because the elderly are not going to be with us that much longer. So the damage it can do is serious now, but is limited in how long it can last. When you subject young people to poverty, it leaves scars and damages and interrupted well-being and health problems, and it multiplies and it lasts and affects society for a longer time. Wow. The Great Recession, this is their conclusion. The Great Recession has brought suffering and lifelong risks to an extra 2 million children in Mexico, 1.7 million in the United States, 619,000 in Italy, and 444,000 in France. The problems have not ended for children and their families, and it may well take years for many of them to return to pre-crisis, that is, pre-2007, levels of well-being. Wow. A whole generation damaged. Capitalism is a system that brings these crises over and over again. It is the system that imposes these kinds of damage on people. And it is a stunning commentary on a system that delivers this kind of report card, if you will. The last major item for which we will have time today concerns the relationship between capitalism and democracy, one that you often send messages to me about, which we read, and that's partly why we have it on the agenda for today. Capitalism came into the world as the dominant economic system back in the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe, first in Britain, and then on the continent, and from there it spread. And the capitalist system, the system of an employer, employee, an enterprise, a corporation, all of that, workers selling their ability to work for a wage, all of that. Capitalism replaced generally two other systems that had been very important in the prior thousands of years of European history. One was called feudalism, where you have lords of the land and serfs, people who were stuck on the piece of land where they were born because they, in a sense, had to stay there because that was the only way to survive. Their parents were serfs of some large lord who lorded it over them. So capitalism came out of serfdom or feudalism in Europe, or it replaced slavery, a situation where one person wasn't a serf and another one was a lord. Instead, one person was the property of another, the slave and the master. So having often with violence overthrown a slave system, that was the Civil War in the United States, or having overthrown with violence the feudal system, that was the French Revolution in 1789, capitalism boasted for a long time that it was the bearer of democracy. What did it mean? Well, it meant, look, we were part of the revolution that overthrew and got rid of slavery. We were part of the revolution that overthrew and got rid of serfdom, feudalism. We don't allow people to be slaves anymore. We freed them. And we don't allow people to be serfs anymore. We liberated and freed them. See, capitalism is freedom. Capitalism is democracy. I want everyone to understand that while it is true that capitalism arises in Europe with the demise of slavery and the demise of feudalism, it is not true that capitalism represents democracy. The problem is precisely that what capitalism did is get rid of master and slave. It got rid of lord and serf. But it substituted for those relationships another one very much like it, called employer and employee. Let's review. The master can control what the serf does, the master can control what the slave does, because the slave is the property of the master, like his horse, like his furniture, like his garden. The lord can control the serf, because the serf has to stay there, because the serf has nowhere else to go, because the parents of the serf are themselves serfs. So the serf is stuck, and the lord has extraordinary power. But now let's review. What is the power of the board of directors of a modern corporation, which is where most employees earn their living? It's a handful of people, 12 to 15, usually. They make all the decisions, whether you have a job, whether you keep a job, what you earn at the job, what your job experience is like, what chances you have or don't have for any kind of improvement in your life. They have all the basic decisions. And what's your power over them? Nothing. You don't like what they do? You can leave. And if you leave the job, you know what you can do? You can choose between starving or going to work for another employer who will have the same power over you that the one had that you left. In other words, capitalism substitutes a new and different kind of undemocratic control. You have to be able to see, yes, capitalism got rid of slavery. Yes, capitalism got rid of feudalism. Even though if I had more time, I'd talk to you about how capitalism and slavery worked things out for long periods of time, and ditto capitalism and feudalism. But let's be generous. Eventually, capitalism pushed aside, overthrew, got rid of slavery and feudalism. But what it substituted was another system that isn't so different, that is fundamentally undemocratic. It doesn't allow you to have control. If the idea of democracy is what it always was, that the mass of people have to be given the power to determine what happens to them, that anyone who has decision-making power over a community has to be subject to the power of that community. Otherwise, you don't have democracy. That's why we make all politicians subject to the elections that we have. At least some control of those who are governed over those who do the governing. But when we walk into our jobs, right? When we walk into that corporate headquarters, we walk into a place 5 days a week, the best hours of those days, where a tiny group of people can make decisions that affect us, but over which we have absolutely no power. Capitalism overthrew undemocratic predecessors, but it installed instead an undemocratic alternative. That's what has to be faced. Because until we do, we can't be surprised that the undemocratic capitalist corporation makes a tiny group of people, the major shareholders and the board of directors, as rich as this program has shown them to be. And we can't be surprised that they allow tens of millions of children to live in poverty when the wealth is there to make sure that didn't exist. We have to face that we live with the consequences of an undemocratic economic order. Thank you for your attention. This is Richard Wolff. A reminder again, our two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. My thanks as well to the truthout.org outfit. They do a wonderful job of commentary and analysis every day. I urge you to check them out at truthout.org. I hope you enjoyed this program, and I look forward to being with you again next week.
My time, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.